Well, good morning. It's a Thursday, and I am your host, Tom Moulton. I'm the executive director of Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance, and behind the glass is Matt Neely, our producer. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Tom. How you doing?
Great. We're back again, and we're going to do a little bit of a difference here. Hope everything goes well, and stand by for cut one. Matt, we're going to be talking to a good friend of mine, Scott Marchand, who is the CEO of Pima Air and Space, a Titan Missile Museum, and a brand new museum called the Tucson Military Vehicle Museum. So we got a lot to talk about today. Scott will be joining us around 8 o'clock, but we got a lot of things we want to talk about. And let's start with our co-host, Tim Bimmerstedt. Good morning, Timmy.
Good morning, Tommy. How are you, sir?
Great, great. So this is the segment where Tim gets to share some of his best events that are happening this weekend and into the summer. So go ahead, and Tim, and take it away.
Sounds good. Starting off, one of my favorites, Summer Safari Nights at Reed Park Zoo begins this Friday, tomorrow, and every Friday and Saturday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. It's really just a great family outing. Highly recommend that one. And then at the Keno Sports Complex, we have FC Tucson versus Coachella, 7 p.m. And then encourage you to hurry. The exhibit is ending at the Mini Time Machine of Miniatures, Stages of Imagination, the iconic Broadway designs of David Korins. And that ends on May 31st.
Okay, well, we're live on air here, so I will continue on with Tim while we try to get him back. But what he was talking about is a brand new exhibit, but it's closing on May 31st. So the iconic Broadway designs of David Korin. So you want to make sure you don't miss that. And our sponsor, and along with Tucson Downtown Partnership, has put together. Timmy?
I'm here.
All right, let's go ahead and talk about the Summer Streetcar Savings Pass.
All right. Hop on, save big, ride the Sunlink, and enjoy summer specials at your favorite local spots. All you have to do is flash your digital savings pass at participating businesses that are located near the streetcar line and unlock your exclusive deals all season long. It's free and available to you to download on your smartphone at visittucson.org/streetcar savings. So be sure to go to thisistucson.org.
Well, it looks like we're having some technical difficulties, but if you would like to know more about these events, go to tucson.com or visittucson.org. Well, thank you, Tim, and sorry about those technical difficulties, but we are live here today, and this is The Morning Voice. And as I mentioned, I am your host every Thursday. Now, Scott Marchand will be up at 8 o'clock, but we had a previous interview with Scott in March of 2024, and since that was a show over a year ago, we thought what we would do is give you a little bit of background on Pima Air and Space. So Matt and I were able to dig through the hundreds of shows that the Jump in Tucson did in 2024. And some of our shows in 2025, as you know, became The Morning Voice. So, Matt, if you're ready, let's go ahead and go to cut one, because we want to hear about the history of Pima Air and Space and the museum. And go ahead, if you're ready for that, Matt.
Yeah, so our collection was formed across the street from us at the what's now called the 309th AMARG facility, Aerospace Maintenance Regeneration Group. Back in the 1950s, they were the Military Aerospace Disposition Center, nicknamed MASDIC, and there was a real diverse population of aircraft in the 40s and 50s as a consequence of World War II in Korea and the dawn of the jet age. So in the 50s and towards the late 50s, there were a lot of, you know, aircraft that had done their time, served their time, and were being designated for reclamation and scrapping. You know, Tucson being a much smaller and less formal community at that time, and that certainly included the military. I don't even think big parts of the facility were really seriously fenced off at the time either.
Oh, okay.
But a lot of the staff over at Mazdak had been pulling one or two aircraft from the hundreds that they were scrapping and were parking them along Gulf Links Road on the north side of the facility, and that sort of became nicknamed Celebrity Row. In the early 60s, there was close to 50 aircraft of different types and significance parked along there, and an inspector general team from the Pentagon came out to visit the facility and toured around and said, you know, gentlemen, what's up with these airplanes? They're supposed to be scrapped. And they said, well, it seems really shame. And they had a sense of history even then, even though aviation, you know, at that point was barely, you know, 50, 60 years since the Wright brothers. So what sprang from that is the commander of the time and several other community leaders, Morrissey Dahl, the Grossettas, and other people in the community, said, look, if we can find some way to get these aircraft off the facility, create an air park, you know, are you guys on board with it? And the Pentagon guys and the Air Force said, yeah, sure, we can play along with that. Little did they know it was going to take us about 14 years to get our act together. But in 1966, we formally chartered, and then we purchased the perpetual land use patent from the Bureau of Land Management, which became administered by Pima County, which is where the least attractions come in. So as long as we are forming the function of an aerospace heritage organization, we have a perpetual right to do that on the property. So we're getting now, God, close to 60 years from our paperwork anniversary, but coming up on our 50th anniversary of opening for business. So we opened in May of 1976, just a month before the bicentennial, as part of the bicentennial celebrations that were widespread across the nation at the time. And we opened with our 50 aircraft from Celebrity Row, and we've been on the grow ever since. We're closing in on probably 500 aircraft now.
And you started off with one hangar, and how many hangars do you have now?
Well, we started off with no hangars.
Oh,
we had a lot of dirt.
All outside.
We had a little Airstream trailer, and then not long after that, the base engineers brought over an old barracks building, which was the first administration building. They were busy turning those all into toothpicks in the 70s. And after that, we just continued to grow, and every couple of years we've been able to expand some of our operations to enhance visitor experience and preserve and present more of our collection.
So it's both an indoor and an outdoor facility. Mm-hmm. And what's the average stay time when somebody comes in and really wants to see everything out there?
Oh, well, if you really want to come in and see everything in any depth and detail, usually they do a two-day pass.
That's great. Oh, yep. That's fantastic.
But if you're just window shopping, it's 3 or 4 hours.
Right. And you also have a tram for those that have a little difficulty walking outside.
Yes, we do. Yep.
And that's daily?
Weather dependent, okay. And condition of the equipment. Every now and then we have things that are beyond our control and we're not able to offer them. But generally, yes, we try to make several runs available on a daily basis.
You know, and I didn't quite know the backstory completely. Years ago, we had the opportunity, Pima County as well as Channel 13, to do a television special, 30-minute, on Pima Air, the history of Pima Air and Space. And I learned some things today that weren't in that TV special. But
you're talking to the wrong people, Tom.
That was part one of our interview with Scott Marchand. And we talked during that conversation about the 30-minute TV specials that were put together, and I wanted to share with you where you could find those, because we did four of them totally, but we did two on Pima Air and Space and Titan Missile Museum, and then we did one just on the Titan Missile Museum. So these are 30-minute videos, highly produced by the KOD group, and as well as the Pima County and the Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance. And they, if you were to go to YouTube and in the search put 30-minute TV specials on PMer and Space or 30-minute TV specials on KLD, you'll be able to find these. They're timeless because they talk exactly about how PMer and Titan was formed. And in an interview, some of the folks that were still alive at the time and the co-founders of both of these locations. So, Tim, I know you were there during some of those formative years, and we'll talk a little bit with Tim about some of the special things that happened when he was there, especially the paper airplane promotion. I think that was probably the neatest thing, and that's still going on. So this is the Morning Voice, and we're going to take our first break, and we'll be back with more about PMer Air and Space as we prepare for the live interview with Scott Marchand, the CEO of PMer Air and Space Museum. This is Tom Moulton, and you're listening to the Morning Voice. Well, we're back, and this is Tom Moulton from the Morning Voice, and we're listening to Scott Marchand, who's not quite here yet, but we had this wonderful interview with him, and we want to get right to, now, Matt, this is cut three, a little bit out of order. We're going to go back to cut two, but we wanted to ask Scott, kind of take us on a virtual tour, and this one's a little bit long, so Matt, we're going to go right into it as soon as you're ready.
So we'll start with there because it's a pretty compact, narrowly focused experience. It's a 45-minute to 90-minute experience, led primarily with the underground guided tour that takes you to the briefing room, down to the underground silo complex, out to view the missile in the silo, and then you have the opportunity to self-guide around the top side and view the exhibits and artifacts that we have up there. We've introduced in the last year or so some audio tours that are self-guiding, that are a supplement to the other materials that we provide. So, you know, your time budget down at Titan is, you know, allow 90 minutes from start to finish if you really want to experience everything. So all the information on how to book your tour and what's involved is available on the website, and other information about other programs and resources are there too. So like most businesses, most of our, you know, general outreach on how to plan your visit and what you're going to experience, what to prepare for, is all contained on the website. So that's your best source of information. The telephone is last century. So, you know, go to the website or follow on Facebook or Instagram. There's always updates on what's happening through social media.
So I recall back when I first went through PMer in Space, there was a mostly emphasis on the military aircraft, but that's changed quite a bit since then.
Well, to be fair, Tom, you know, there was never, the original emphasis was never military aircraft, right?
Okay.
So that was part of the foundational collection, but, you know, when I've gone back and read through early minutes and how they were establishing and the sort of corporate philosophy of the organization, even back in the 60s and up to opening day, it was meant to be a big tent. It was a broad air and space technology history museum. I mean, if like the Hard Rock Cafe, if it flies, it fits, right? I mean, there's room for all of it. And they made very concerted efforts to collect and represent those type of things. You know, we are obviously very deeply representative of military aviation. But if you look at it sort of statistically, you know, most of the dynamic growth, development, and evolution in aviation since 1903 has been driven by warfare and military applications, right? Most of the civilian and commercial spin-off aircraft have been a consequence of military aviation development. So it's completely logical and natural that we have a high representation of military aircraft because they have been the growth stimulator for aerospace.
Right.
Now, it's also helped that we're right across the street from the largest facility for the storage and regeneration of aircraft on the planet. So, and always have been. So we're kind of the spiritual, you know, we're the stepson or the grandchild of AMARC and those military components. And they've been, you know, very important partners of ours over the year. We continue to have excellent relationships, and they're really key to growing and developing our collection. Our campus site is about 80 acres of publicly developed display area, and we've got about 300,000 square feet of indoor display space in a cluster of about five different hangars with different themes. We've got a terrific lunch service restaurant. We've got a playground. Part of our emphasis, certainly under my leadership, is that we need to be accommodating and interesting and receptive to everybody who wants to come. I mean, I think a lot of your formative experience, Tom, was back in the 90s when, unfortunately, we were a little sort of heavily skewed by our leadership and our volunteer corps to lean towards sort of favoritism in the military. And we saw, significant declines in visitorship. I mean, we were seeing steep declines even before 9/11. And afterwards, it's been long uphill climb, in the last 10 or 15 years to really kind of broaden our reach and be more receptive. And now when I look out my office window and walk around and look at, you see, 20 years ago was a lot of, old dudes that looked like you and me kicking around. And now it's multi-generational families, still with the old dudes, driving the visit, but they're bringing along, their wives, their daughters, their grandchildren. We see a lot of mom groups out. There's, we've made a real effort to be clear that there's a lot of history and there's a lot of emphasis and there's a lot of things for everybody, I consistently get feedback from, from visitors that, hey, I got dragged out here by so-and-so and I've got these other museums and, you guys were fantastic because it's really, they really enjoyed, the different perspective and more than just this narrow focused agenda. So,
well, Tucson really needs more family attractions. So you've gone in the right direction.
Oh, yeah, and we do several events every year. We have our Halloween Night of Fright. We do our paper airplane fly-off. We have night wings. We have different, scientific and social themes. Last year, during some of the summer programs, we had community animal rescue groups come out and represent what they're up to. So, we're... We're a great place to bring the community together because we have the space, we have the capacity, and we have the desire to help make our community a better place for everybody.
Now, I brought several kinds of groups out to your museum over the years, and some of them been adults, and one of the things that when they get done with their tours, they say, well, I need to come back with my son or my daughter or my granddaughter.
Yep.
And I think that's a wonderful shift.
Oh, sure.
As you mentioned, because when my first visits, and certainly in the 90s, I didn't have as much gray hair as I have right now. It was pretty people 45 up, very cognizant of the military and how aviation has grown. But then the variety of aircrafts that you mentioned early on, the collection now, it's up to, again, what was that number?
We're getting close to 500 aircraft now.
Wow. And, you used to have a lot of planes parked along the side of your property. Mm-hmm. And over the years, because if you expanded your restoration area, let's talk a little bit about what's happened since the big facility was built.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the facility improvements have just allowed us to enjoy a greater capacity just in terms of not only the numbers of aircraft, but just the volumetric size of them.
Yes.
We're now capable of safely and efficiently painting something like a 747, which 10 years ago certainly wasn't the case without a pretty significant struggle. We were fortunate to have a donor provide the funding to put a large cantilevered roof structure over our outdoor apron and wash rack, which, if you're a local here, from probably May through September, conditions outside are not very comfortable to be working in. And, certainly not when you're working with certain types of materials that are sensitive to heat and temperature. It limits your capacity. So now we have fewer limitations in that context. We have made great strides in developing the collection across sort of all eras and all types. Recently, we've been able to enhance our NASA aircraft collection. We brought into the collection an aircraft, a Boeing 747 SP, which was the SOFIA program. That's Stratospheric Observation for Infrared Astronomy.
So easy for you to say.
Not so easy for me to say, Tom. But this is also a program that had its innovation in Tucson at the U of A in the 1960s. And there's been several platforms that have evolved over the year to conduct infrared astronomy. And so, you know, bringing SOFIA here after the end of its mission was a good spiritual fit and also a good thematic fit for us, and it's proven to be really popular. It's got a global audience. So, you know, all these science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics type of things are one of the big sort of emphasis outside of our historic preservation is encouraging people to look at the aerospace industry as a career field, an academic field. Tucson has always had a very strong aerospace connection. You know, Hughes Missile Systems, now Raytheon, there's Bombardier, there's, you know, two large military communities here. There's Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, 355th Fighter Wing, Air Combat Command, Air Material Command. You've got the 162nd Wing of the Air Guard at the airport. If you've been coming in out of there, you've seen all the F-16s. They've got a training mission for NATO. Up the road in Pinal, there's an Army aviation. It's Southern Arizona is so rich in aviation history. What can I say?
So much to know about what's going on at PM Air. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back to The Morning Voice, and I'm here, your Thursday morning host, along with Matt Neely behind the glass, who's pushing some unique buttons today as we're talking about Pima Air and Space and its related museums, the Titan Missile Museum, and a brand new one we're going to be talking about here in just a few moments when Scott Marchand, the CEO, joins us live in the studio. He's got a couple of things he's going to want to talk about today, and some of it you probably heard regarding this wonderful flying boat airplane that had made a long journey from British Columbia to Lake Pleasant, and then over, I think it was 4 days, right, Matt? It took to the roads and found its way to Pima Air and Space Museum.
Had to take a circuitous route, which I'm sure I don't want to steal his thunder, but it was an interesting story to follow on the news here. So, yeah, absolutely looking forward to his take on that.
Probably one of the most followed stories, certainly in May, they've had a lot of journeys of airplanes over the years, but this one seemed to capture the social media world by a storm. And Scott will be here to talk behind the scenes, is what we're hoping, about all the things that took place when this wonderful large aircraft, I think if I remember right, it emptied 75,573 pounds. So I think they broke it apart a little bit because it had to get under lights and signs and everything. But that's
the biggest flying boat ever produced.
Yeah, that's a lot of weight to travel on the Arizona roads,
Matt. Not as big as the Spruce Goose, but the Spruce Goose they made one prototype of. This actually went into production and went into service, the largest flying boat.
Yeah, the Spruce Goose, if the movie was any truth to it, was it went off, got up off the air a little bit just for, you know, a few minutes or so, and then it went right back down. And they floated it into a big hangar, and it was on display for many, many, many years in Long Beach, California. And now it's somewhere. I'm not quite sure.
I believe it's in Washington State, and yeah. I don't remember exactly what.
But it's still under – though that was the largest airplane. But it really
largest flying boat, yeah.
But it never went into service, as Matt indicated. This particular plane, there were many made, not a lot, but – and they were in service. The plane that Scott's going to talk about was in service actually fighting fires. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Now, one of the things, Tim, are you there? Nope.
I am.
Oh, yes, you are. Good. Because we want to, this is the segment until about 7:45. We're going to talk about things that you did, but in particular, your knowledge about how Pima Air and Space has been quite an educational institution for children. And when you were there, the school group was alive and well, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. We were doing quite a few students a year. And the paper airplane project helped with that quite a bit.
And that's still going on.
I know.
We
yeah,
actually...
That was back in 2012.
Yeah, we actually reported about that on your segment. When the kids got there, and it was a whole event about making paper airplanes and, of course, the science behind why things can lift off. You were a big part of that.
I was. That was the reason I was hired out of PM Air and Space, was to help them with that project. And so I would leave the Desert Museum in the afternoon and go over to marketing council meetings at PM Air and Space and consult with them. And it was an interesting concept. It's the first, what we considered the first introduction to aviation for children was the paper airplane. And so we decided to capitalize on that and create the great paper airplane fly-off. And after the winner, Arturo Valdenegro, threw the longest flight with his paper airplane, we sent him to California, and he started working with a guy named Art Thompson, who was the designer of the B-2 bomber, and building the world's largest paper airplane.
What a great story. Now, I'm going to go ahead and ask Matt in a moment to go to cut two, because we asked that very question to Scott about his educational programming. So let's go ahead with cut two. The educational side is quite amazing, and you have a very unique program for school kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so part of our mission and part of our contribution to the residents of Pima County is that all school groups, K through 12, plus community service groups, say Boys and Girls Club or Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, that type of thing.
Right.
You know, they're eligible for free admission. So the information on those programs is on our website. But they are regulated. You know, at Titan Missile Museum in particular, we do those tours before opening. There's usually one available today. So it's high demand. So if you're interested in going, make arrangements through the website. At the PM Air and Space Museum, it's a little more flexible, but we do limit the number of school groups that are on site at any one given time. We still have to balance that accessibility with our need to generate revenue from our visitors and accommodate everybody who's interested.
Well, I applaud you and your Board of Trustees for maintaining that program, because I know that's a big thrill. Mm-hmm. When my kids were little, hard to believe they were little. It was so many years ago, but we moved here in 1997. They were, 7 and 8 years old, and they visited PM Air and Space really enjoyed, at one time, I think you were doing overnight, kind of sleep in at Titan. Is that still around? So that was just an old program from the past.
Yep.
But the fact that you can bring a school group and be there before the visitors coming, and so I would imagine that's a very unique experience for these school kids.
Yeah, it definitely is. It's a very unique window into how we used to live.
Yeah, and they're continuing their educational programming and... one of the unique kind of promotion they're doing with Pima County is the kids are coming in for free, So that was part of really their agreement to continue inviting the kids. And, of course, what happens is the kids have a great time, and they go home and they tell mom and dad about their experiences. And I think that's probably one of the primary reasons Pima Air and Space and Titan is doing so well with families now. And when I started in 1997 at Old Tucson, we had Harrison Price do a survey of the attractions within Pima County where there was a fairly large family attendants, or we, as we used to say, adults with children. And it was shockingly, we discovered that there was quite a deficiency in attractions that catered to families. Of course, the Desert Museum and others were getting some families, but the majority of them were catering to empty nesters or senior citizens, as we call them, which I am one of those. Over the last 10 years or so, there's been a huge effort to open up attractions that cater to families. So the ropes and ladders and the trampoline museums and the family entertainment centers, there's been quite a few. But more importantly, what's happened is Old Tucson and Pima Air and Space is coming up not only with educational programming, but with programming that are part of the core product. And we're really happy understanding all that's going on. And Tim, you know, this continuing of the this airplane promotion, I think, has a lot to do to keep that fresh and live for folks going back to Pima Air and Space.
I would agree.
Yeah, and thank you for being part of that, Tim. I know that you've been gone from Pima Air and Space, but we keep in touch with Scott and encourage him to continue. And he'll be here at 8 o'clock. And we're going to go ahead, Matt, and take a little bit break earlier, because we got to get back to one segment where Scott's going to talk about we call it the dream segment, and you'll be interesting to hear that what he said almost about a year and 3 months ago and the reality when he gets here at 8 o'clock in the studio. So this is Tom Moulton, and I'm your host of the Morning Voice, and we'll be back for the last segment in just a few moments. Well, we're back with the last segment. This is the Morning Voice, and I am your host, Tom Moulton, Executive Director of the Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance, and we want to thank Visit Tucson for being our big show sponsor. We got one last segment, and this is going to be a nice setup for Scott Marchand, the CEO of Pima Air and Space, the Titan Missile, and a brand new one, and he's going to be talking about in just a few moments. So he's in the studio, but at the interview that we had with Scott, we asked him in the last segment, what are some of the things that are going to be happening at Pima Air and Space in the future? We call this the dream segment. So go ahead with cut four. So this is going to be kind of our dream segment, Scott. Pima Air and Space and Titan have grown over many times over with new exciting opportunities, new experiences, new airplanes, new tours. But if you had to think about what's going to be going on and something you're allowed to share with the rest of us, can you tell us about some of those near and far dreams of what's going to happen to these two facilities?
Right. So our near dream is actually coming to fruition, is under construction right now. Several years ago, we reacquired the 77 acres to the east of us that are not part of our BLM allotment. And it came with some challenges on the land there, and it took a few years to hammer out some details, and of course, you know, COVID, Monkey Ranch, and interrupted some fundraising efforts, but we managed to pull it over the hill, and in October, we broke ground on the Tucson Military Vehicle Museum that we're constructing, so that should be opening to the public this November, provided construction stays on track, and that's going to be a pretty unique experience for visitors in the Southwest. I mean, as many aviation museums are scattered around the country, there's very few military vehicle museums that aren't a function of a private collector or, you know, in behind secure facilities of the military. So we're going to be featuring and focusing historic military vehicles from all ages and all eras and all nations, like we've done with the aircraft. On that new museum campus, we're going to be having a riding and driving program there. We've been fortunate with our existing loan partner relationships that we've been able to get significant historic vehicles on loan already from the Marine Corps and the Army, a few from the Air Force here and there. We've had some donated. We're doing a little bit of shopping, so it's going to be pretty spectacular. you know, it's one of these things that you got to remember, you know, aviation, I mean, you might wonder, well, what's that's kind of a thematic departure, but in reality it isn't, because aviation since 1914 has really evolved as a logistical and tactical and strategic support for the military mission on the ground. A lot of commercial aerospace was developed to resupply military ventures, certainly came in very punctuated leaps from the First World War to the Second World War to the Vietnam era to the modern era. So all of these things are tightly interlinked and interwoven. So, you know, having an opportunity to expand our mission, celebrate a little bit more about the experiences and the service and sacrifice of our military community, both here and abroad, we thought was real important to do. There's always been an interest in having a more experiential and hands-on component to our mission, and that's been hard to do with aircraft without an airfield and without the resources to fly and operate. So we hope we can sort of tap into that a little bit more by giving people an opportunity to see some of these unique military vehicles operating, and even take the opportunity to, you know, get behind the wheel or just, you know, ride in one of them for fun.
Well, we're back, and Scott Marchand is in the studio, and he'll be live here at 8:03. But I think you'll hear that he was pretty spot on what exactly has been going on at Pimarin Space since that last interview that we had with Scott a little bit over a year ago. And it was interesting to hear from Tim about how the educational activities have really taken off and how that has expanded their family attendance. I think that was something that when Scott and I were talking about this, we're wondering, you know, how was the family attendance going on at Pimarin Space? And we were happy to hear that when you go out there and you're looking at the airplanes, you're also seeing a lot of families, especially with children, enjoying the over 500 aircraft that are out there. So this is kind of a little bit of a tease, but recently, if you were on Facebook or anything digital, you learned about this brand new aircraft that took, it took months to get here, but there's a big story behind this. And that's why we're fortunate to have Scott Marchand here, the CEO of Pimarin Space and Titan Missile, and the brand new museum that he'll be talking about, that he actually shared with us a small story about. The last time we had that opportunity to have him in the studio. So we can't wait to 8 o'clock when Scott will be with us. And I just wanted to thank you for listening to some of the history of Pimarin Space and some of the dreams. And we'll be right back. This is Tom Moulton, and you're listening to The Morning Voice. We'll be right back. Well, we're back, and good morning. This is the 8 o'clock segment, and as we've been promising, Scott Marchand, the CEO of Pimarin, I always have to say all three of them now. Maybe, Scott, if that's okay, because I asked you the question last time you were on the air about the Arizona Aerospace Foundation and how that is the kind of fundraising, the nonprofit arm.
Well, it's the parent.
The parent organization. But I want to make sure when I say you're the CEO, of all of these wonderful museums under that umbrella, including a new one that we're going to be talking about. But it's so nice to see you again. I don't get a chance to see much of you these days because you're so busy. And I want to get right to the story. But I want to say good morning, Tim. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
So your good friend is sitting here across from me on the microphone.
Oh, awesome. And Tom, I don't mean to hurt your feelings by this, but Scott is by far my favorite coworker in my long career in tourism.
Well, thank you, Tim.
Well, he's certainly warrants when I've only had a few shows on the air when I'm out of town called The Best Of, and Scott's been one of those, and we shared some segments today as we were preparing for his arrival. But Scott, you've been in the news quite a bit lately.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not me personally, but by extension, I guess we're attracting a bit of attention.
Yeah, and you know, this is something when we ran the Dream segment, you were under construction of the newest museum, just adjacent to PMAER in space, and you know, the Tucson Military Vehicle Museum. We can probably now talk about it. It's been open since April 12th.
Yep.
And Scott's, we're going to talk a little bit about that in segment 3 and 4, but I wanted to share part of the conversation and make sure we have plenty of time, because as I mentioned to Scott several times now, you're always thinking, or maybe sometimes it just happens, of the story that's going to go crazy or viral, I guess the digital world says. And I didn't know much about this until it first appeared on it was Facebook or Instagram or one of those, where this largest flying boat built in World War II was coming to PMAER in space. And Scott, being the curator and of all of the airplanes, well, most of the airplanes that are there, and the knowledge that you have about all the airplanes that are there, and then all of a sudden here pops up another new airplane. And I'm going to let you carry the story from there.
Well, I'll turn it right back on you, Tom. Why don't you ask me what you want to know? Because I don't really know how to start the narrative on this.
Let's start with what happened when you heard about this airplane maybe being available.
Well, that goes back a little way. So shortly before COVID, we'd been approached by the Colson Aviation Group at the museum. They had done a deal with the Norwegian Air Force to purchase 4 retired C-130 Hercules from the Norwegians that they were going to convert into water tankers. And they needed a location and facility to perform return to flight work and basic ferry permit testing and regeneration, so they could take it to their facility in Thermal, California, and complete the tanker conversions. So, and we've got a practice at the museum that wherever possible, you know, we'll assist, you know, federal agencies or public agencies that are doing, you know, humanitarian and good work for, you know, whether it's, you know, the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Forest Service, NASA, Colson Group doing the public firefighting and aerial tanking work globally, it was a good fit. So over several years, they rotated these aircraft through and regenerated them for flight. And we got to know their leadership team and their owners and the family reasonably well through, you know, through, well, years of doing business and hosting them and back and forth. And, you know, just over lunch one day, the topic of the Martin Mars came up. And, you know, initially, it's kind of like, I don't see how this could happen. I mean, we're in the middle of a desert. It's a flying boat. It's enormous, and kind of rolled on for there. But the topic kept coming up a little bit, and you know, so we decided to take a little more of a serious look at the feasibility. I mean, before any decisions were made, you know, the critical thing to evaluate was if we can get it to a reasonably localized body of water, there's going to be an overroad component, there's going to be disassembly, there's reassembly. What's possible, you know, because it's not to give away the ending, it turns out it's possible, but you know, we didn't know it at the time, so we had to commission a route survey company. We had to sort of make an educated guess at how high the load is possibly going to be. And so once we did the route feasibility survey, we said, okay, well, that's great. Looks like we, you know, in theoretically it's possible. You know, the next key was identifying a suitable body of water. And, you know, that turned out to be, there was one choice. And if that choice wasn't willing to work with us, then the project wouldn't happen. But fortunately, the good people at Maricopa County and their parks director, Jennifer Ordell, and everybody, got on board with this and were super supportive. The reason we ended up at Lake Pleasant was because of the access roads out of the site. And they also had a 10-lane boat ramp there that has sufficient width and angle to get the Mars out of the water. They had a large enough parking lot that we could stage equipment. And the roads out of the park were sufficiently straight that we could, move a 140-foot load down to the route. And that's not always true on all roads. I mean, there's a lot of people, the self-appointed experts on the interwebs had all determined that it was going to go to Lake Roosevelt, which, as far as lakes go, it's a beautiful lake, and their organization out there was, very eager to cooperate, but there's just too many narrow switchback roads in and out of that that park, so it was impossible.
Now you've transported some planes over mm-hmm. the road, but yes. Nothing like this.
Well, similar. We moved the B-36 from Fort Worth, which is comparable in some respects, but simpler in others because it's a narrower fuselage, more cylindrical, not as tall. It wasn't without its challenges, but it was nothing in the realm of what the Mars presented.
Now, part of the B-36, getting it to Pima Air and Space, was it all over the road, or were you able to fly it into somewhere?
Oh, it was all over the road. Okay. Yeah.
So
that's the cheapest way to do it.
And this was this particular airplane, the Philippine Mars, you were able to fly it here.
Yes.
And was it continuously operational right before the flight, or had it been sitting in an aircraft hangar waiting for its next home?
It had not flown since 2007.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the Colson Aviation Group acquired the Philippine and Hawaii Mars in, I think, 2005, 2006 from another company. And they converted and operated the Hawaii Mars to a digital cockpit, and they spent quite a few years firefighting with it. And the Hawaii the Philippine Mars that we have was really intended to be more of a backup airplane, and they discovered that the cost of the conversion, and while it's dramatic, and they did terrific service over the years, principally in Western Canada and the Pacific Northwest, and occasionally down into Mexico and South America over the years, the fact that they were flying boats severely limited where they could operate from, right? So that made them more costly, slightly less effective than more modern firefighting apparatus. And at that point in time, these airplanes were close to 70 years old, had been used very heavily. There was increasing cost to keep them airworthy. There's increasing risk, and the decision was made to retire them. I believe the BC, British Columbia Forestry Department basically stepped in and said, look, we're not really willing to contract these anymore. We feel there's too high a liability risk to us as your contractors to operate these.
So out of service in 2007.
Yeah, the Hawaii Mars continued to fly operational until about 2015.
Okay. So, all right. Yeah. Okay. So in addition to doing the survey regarding mm-hmm. the on-ground yep. transportation, you also had that other challenge. Mm-hmm. Will it get off the air and fly
yep.
to Lake Pleasant?
Yep.
So we got about 2 minutes left on this. Let's talk a little bit about that. What are some of the things they had to do in order to get this flying boat to fly again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The biggest challenge was making sure that propellers and power plants were suitable for the long-range flight. Of course, the rest of the aircraft systems needed to be, checked and double-checked. There's a fairly extensive sort of return-to-flight protocol for all aircraft that have been storage, and, they have to meet certain government criteria. In this case, it needed to satisfy Transport Canada as well as the Federal Aviation Administration. So there were, two agencies looking over the shoulders of the Colson maintenance team while they were preparing for this flight.
And then they were months away from taking off. Was there any setbacks when you got closer to liftoff, so to speak?
Oh, look, none of this went smoothly. It, you know, everybody was, you know, hopefully optimistic. And so we purchased the airplane and concluded the deal with the Colsons in March of 2024. And of course, they were already committed to doing the refurbishment and ferry flight of the Hawaii Mars to British Columbia Aviation Museum in Vancouver. That was scheduled for August of last year. So a lot of their focus was on that immediate delivery. And they elected to focus their energies that summer on Hawaii Mars. And then they began work on Philippine Mars in September, October last year.
So we'll pick it up from there, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
This is Tom Moulton, and this is The Morning Voice, and we're listening about how the Philippine Mars made its way to Pima Air and Space for all of you to see it. We'll be right back. Well, good morning. We're back, the Morning Voice. And Matt, thank you so much. It's always exciting when Matt plays songs related to the conversation that we're having today with Scott Marchand, who is the CEO of Pima Air and Space. And we've been talking about the Philippine Mars flying boat, a very unique aircraft that was built in World War II time and served with the Navy. And then it ended up really going back and forth, as I understand it, with medical supplies and then became a firefighting piece of equipment and then sat vacant after 2007. And then there was some discussion going on about how wonderful it is to preserve this aircraft. And obviously, preserving aviation, preserving aircraft is one of the missions of Pima Air and Space. And here we are. It's there, being put back together again. And Scott, as we opened up the show today saying, my goodness gracious, this was a marketing manager's dream. If you didn't know where Pima Air and Space was, or if you didn't even know Pima Air and Space, one of the largest aviation museums in, quite frankly, the world, boy, you sure as heck know where it is now because of the Philippine Mars flying boat story was well told. And congratulations, Scott, for you and your team. And I know it's part work and it's a lot of luck. And certainly the passion of aviation history is alive and well, isn't it?
Oh, it sure is. And I'm certainly not unique in that in that department. There's a global community of aviation nuts, and it's a great community to be a part of.
Well, it's wonderful to have passionate people, especially you know, I was at a workshop yesterday, and we started off with where you work, the same part of your values. And my discussion as part of the workshop was about passion. And the folks that are so passionate about their job, it doesn't become a job. It becomes their life's work. And clearly, when we first interviewed, this was not something when you were 10 years old and said, I love airplanes and I want to be in acquisition.
No.
But you are the top of your field, and I think it showed when the Philippine Mars started its long journey from British Columbia, and that's where we left off.
Yeah.
So now the plane has gone through the inspections and the FAA in the United States and the equivalent program over in Canada says, okay, the risk is, you know, been minimized, and now it's going to make its 1,500-mile initial journey to Lake Superior. Can you pick it up from there?
Yeah, so after the Hawaii Mars was delivered to Vancouver in August, you know, the Colson maintenance team turned their attention to Philippine. And, you know, retrospectively, I think everybody was a little too optimistic about how straightforward it was going to be. You know, in the course of regenerating Hawaii Mars to fly to Vancouver, you know, the decision was made to swap out several components to the Philippine Mars, propellers, and initially they were going to swap all the engines, but then elected to reactivate the ones that were on them and you know, deal with whatever problems came up as they came up. And that proved to be Well, it turned out not to save anybody any time. Initially, the first ferry flight was supposed to commence at the end of October, be into Lake Pleasant first week of November. After meeting, you know, ferry criteria and some test flights around the area in British Columbia, they set out on the first leg of the ferry flight, and they got about 2 hours in and started getting some funny instrument readings, principally around oil pressure on I think the number three engine. So they elected to return to base and sort that out. And it took about 10 days to narrow it down to a not so much a problem with the engine itself, but a fault in one of the monitoring gauges, one of the sensor probes that sits in the engine. So that was remedied, and more test flights commenced, and they did about 20 more hours in the region and decided to go again. And of course, by that point, the wet Western Canadian British Columbia winter had closed in, it made all of these efforts three or four times order of magnitude more challenging for everybody. But they were, they persevered and decided we were going to get off the ground or off the water just before Christmas last year, and hopefully get in before the new year, and then take a bit of a break and take it apart. And this time they got about 4.5 hours into the flight, and they started having oil pressure problems with the engine again. Returned back to Sprott Lake, and the decision was taken then that they were going to swap an engine with Hawaii, Mars, and Vancouver. So that took several more weeks, and then you have to reset with all of the testing and everything, re-getting the ferry permits, giving the maintenance crews and the flight crews up there, some chance to rest, because they'd been going hard since, really April, May of 2024 on these airplanes. So they were reaching, and you got to remember too, like this, not only is this an old airplane, but the skills necessary to maintain the old airplane lives in old guys. So a lot of these, some of these guys had come out of retirement to do this work in the Farewell Project. So I think sort of the average age of the crews working on the return to flight was about 70 years old. So and certainly some younger guys and a few older, but it was, as we all get older, the physical demands take more out of you faster and recovery is longer. So,
yeah, I just, it's happening right now with the Reno from old Tucson, where it's back to its original home in Virginia, and it's predominantly volunteers. Don't know whether these folks were being paid or not. Not important, but it's certainly to get out of retirement. So the passion in helping this plane get here is obviously a great honor to its resting place at Pima Air & Space. And just as one day, maybe the Reno will return to old Tucson for a for tour. It's the passion of restoration to see it operate one more time. What had to be live and well.
Yep. Yeah. No. I mean, there's certainly a lot of enthusiasm for seeing old machinery of all types perform the way it was intended to, and that comes with risks and comes with challenges and comes with, as we all know, old things. No matter how well you look after them, they've got a mind of their own.
As I'm aging, I understand that.
Yeah. So at the end of January, we were ready for our third attempt. Some of our initial plans were to make a little bit more of a farewell show of this. We talked last fall about maybe doing a couple days in San Diego to give people more of a chance to see it. But after these two aborted ferry flights and some of the other anticipated challenges, the decision was taken. We are just going to do a point-to-point dash as efficiently as possible. So once the aircraft took off for its third attempt, which turned out to be successful, flew into San Francisco. It overnighted at Oakland at the old seaplane base there, not too far from the USS Hornet Aircraft Carrier Museum. And they were greeted with great ceremony, enthusiasm. The harbor fire department came out and gave them a fire hose, washdown and send off, and it was but then the practical stuff had to happen there too. They had to clear customs, and we had to finalize permits for entry into the U.S. and that type of stuff. So there's some paperwork that had to happen there, and then the next morning it was off to the dash to Lake Pleasant. And that turned out to be a pretty pretty eventful and exciting last leg too, because once the the Mars got over Arizona, our friends from Goshawk Aviation up in Casa Grande here, who operate a consolidated privateer Navy patrol bomber, that you probably can see at air shows around here if you're familiar with that type of thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And several of the other pilots that that they do maintenance on, their Mustang, their T6, and the privateer came up, and they formated up with the Mars as it came into Lake Pleasant, and there's some really incredible photography that came out of that, and it was a great morale boost for everybody involved, and it was sort of anticlimactic after the last landing and the last flight. I mean, the weather conditions were perfect up there. The lake was nice and glassy. There wasn't much activity on the lake.
Well, from an operation standpoint, that may be true. From a marketing standpoint, it was just about ready to begin once again.
Yep.
We'll be back. This is The Morning Voice, and I'm Tom Moulton, and my guest today is Scott and Marshawn, longtime CEO and acquisition curator of Pimair and Space. We'll be right back. Well, we're back. This is The Morning Voice, and I'm your host, Tom Moulton, and in studio, special guest Scott Marshawn, the CEO of Pimair and Space. And we're talking about the Philippine Mars flying boat that left British Columbia, 1,500-mile trip. Without some major challenges, but they were all overcome, and it landed in Lake Pleasant not too long ago. Scott,
yeah, first week of February.
Yep. And let's pick up the story from there. It lands, and
once it landed, then the real work began. Right. So it was getting it on the beach and beginning to disassemble it and prepare for transport down here to Tucson for display. As you can imagine, so. So the airplane is huge. It's about 120 feet long. It's got a 48-high-foot tail and a 200-foot wingspan. And the fuselage with the beaching gear on the ground, I mean, the cockpit is sitting right around 30 feet off the ground, so 3-4 stories off the ground if you're, comparing it to a building, right? So we contracted with a specialist aircraft dismantling and transport agent who we've worked with for 35 years out here, Marty Batura and his guys. They've worked out of our museum several times doing government contracts, moving B-52s. So they absolutely had the skills and the ability to do this. And when we moved the B-36 20 years ago, Southwest Industrial Rigging, which is has a local office here, and parent companies up in Phoenix. They were vital to our success in that project. So when this came up, we went to them first because they're turnkey solutions for heavy haul, complex moves. They've got the cranes, the trucks, the crews, the know-how. Mm-hmm. And so Marty and the guys at Southwest Industrial partnered up and swung into dismantling the airplane. It took them about three, four weeks to get it completely dismantled and ready to transport. The fuselage itself was really the biggest challenge. So as it happens, at its road height of 26 feet, it's the tallest load to ever move in Arizona. And it took 6 days across multiple jurisdictions. We were ready to go several weeks ago on a Sunday night, and one of the DPS elements had to drop out for an emergency, so that kiboshed that plan. So, but when you're coordinating with probably 20 or 30 different utility companies, jurisdictions, police departments, escorts, you don't just pick up and go the next day. So it took another several weeks to get us back on track for
all that coordination. This was all part of this aircraft transportation company helped you do all of that?
Yeah, I mean, my principal role was, writing checks at this point. So,
and a lot of donations, wasn't there?
yeah. So Yeah, so the dismantling guys worked, you know, very closely with Southwest Industrial, and you know, the logistics team at SWIR, they took over all of the permitting plan, because this is what they do professionally, right? They move giant transformers, wind turbines, mining equipment. So this is their bread and butter. So
thank goodness.
Yeah. So we turned them loose to take care of that, and after 6 days of movement, it arrived early morning on May 11th at the museum, and we sprung straight into the main wing center boxes back on, and the guys are busy putting back all the other thousands of smaller fasteners and riveting fairings back on. So it's going to take 6 to 8 weeks to put it back together. It's going to take roughly the same time to go back as it took apart.
Now, will you move it one more time and have a resting place for a while?
Oh, it'll move several more times before it has a final resting place. I mean, it's going to be displayed outside for the foreseeable future. And, you know, we're entertaining plans to put a building around it. But, you know, as a wise person once said to me, we don't have any problems that money won't solve. So at this point, it's a matter of money.
Completely different story. Yeah. What happened with the Spruce Goose.
Yes.
That building was tided. Mm-hmm. Well, exciting trip.
Yes.
Nevertheless. And, of course, you had your day-to-day activities.
Oh, sure.
Going on at the museum as well. And this was kind of like a side job for mm-hmm. you. I'm sure some days it consumed some of your team.
It certainly takes up a lot of attention and energy from everybody.
But the marketing side, we got a minute or so before we, for those listening, we are going to be talking about the Tucson Military Vehicle Museum in just a moment, but from being a marketing guy that we help support you through the Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance marketing, it was a dream for us as well, mm-hmm. because we intensively watched as each post took place. And we immediately reposted to all of our resources, and it was hard to keep up.
Oh, yeah.
To be honest with you, there was so much going on, and it wasn't just one little video that went viral.
Yeah.
And the photography and the videography was delicious. I mean, in my business, we call that delicious, because it was almost something you could consume.
Sure.
You know, I mean, you wanted to, when's the next one coming out? And because it definitely captured the challenges and the long journey from when it took off to when it landed, and to some it may have been boring watching the traffic light have to be moved to the left or right or whatever, but just the understanding the challenges of taking something down the road, because we've all seen windmills and big water towers, but it's always fun when you see an aircraft or any kind of military machinery go down the road on the interstate, especially if you're a kid.
Yeah.
You know, and so there was this 72-year-old kid, now 73, mm-hmm. watching these videos attentively, wanting to get them out to our resources to help, kind of in a sense, we piggybacked off the viral story. Mm-hmm. But it was, oh, my goodness gracious, it was one of the most amazing stories for Tucson and for Pima Air and Space and for all the attractions here to see something like this. I always say, you know, don't think small. Don't put in this or that. Put in a whole area. And this, because it's just the massive story and size of this aircraft, it's almost like, you know, putting in, you know, an entire themed area, because you got this wonderful aircraft with lots of history and the immense size of it. And I remember the B-36 was pretty special, mm-hmm. But this is probably, I don't know if I'm exaggerating, Scott, three times, four times more coverage.
Oh, yeah. This is blown up in ways that I don't think anybody could have planned for. We certainly hope for it. But we're fortunate, too, because we've got good partnerships with several, you know, people around that can help with this type of stuff. And this time around, it was Ramon Purcell of Boneyard Safari, who's one of his side gigs as an aviation nerd. And fortunately, he had the professional flexibility to be able to follow the project with us and be on site and do the updates. And, you know, he's really made it the viral event that it has become.
So the P. Marin's Pace has been on the news ever since the opening of the Tucson Military Vehicle Museum, and that was just in April. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, that's okay, it opened.
Yep.
And to a lot of fanfare. And now you have this new story. So you've been on a roll here for a while.
Well, we have. Nowhere to go but down now.
That's
Tom.
Right. That's, oh, yeah. Well, you know, the marketing guy is probably thinking, okay, what can I do that's bigger than the Philippine Mars? All right. So the Military Museum opened on April 12th.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how we're limited on time, but we'll try to squeeze all this in a little bit of time we got. So you had this patch of land, and we talked about that before.
Yeah.
But before you even bought the land, you had this vision of what to do with it.
No, we didn't, Tom.
Oh,
So the land is kind of funny. So we had actually had that portion of land donated to us in the early 90s.
Right.
And we held on to it for about 10, 15 years. And then when we were doing a hangar expansion in 2006, you know, we needed some resources to put in that. So the decision was taken to actually sell the land at that point, because really we had no idea what we would do with it.
Okay.
You know, as it turns out, there's a lot of restrictions on that property with respect to stormwater, flight path, noise. So it was a challenge for anybody to develop. So, so as it happened, Paul Baker and Don Diamond had purchased the land from us back at that time, and another entity had sort of split the parcel with them. And when we took the decision to reacquire the land as really as much a buffer, because we were kind of like, our part of Tucson had been pretty sleepy for a long time, but as everybody knows, in the last several years, it's really kind of exploded, and places that have been left ignored are suddenly million square foot shipping and receiving places. And we started to get a bit concerned, like, oh god, what kind of neighbor are we gonna have next door, and that could have a negative impact on what we're doing. So we undertook to get the land back, and the Bakers and the Diamonds were generous, and they donated their portion back, and we were able to purchase the other portion from the owner and reconsolidated it. And then we're kind of at, well, now what, right? Because it wasn't really suitable for expansion of the air park, and truthfully, we have plenty of room for any aircraft we're likely to get for 100 years where we are now. And like I said, with some of the the riparian areas, the noise restrictions, the flight path stuff, the usable portion of the land for development was actually quite compact, right? So, we all were sort of sitting around, and look, we're all history nerds and gearheads and geeks, and we'd had several military vehicles in the collection, radar trucks and fire trucks and things, and a lot of us travel, and in Europe in particular, there's a trend to sort of active military vehicle museums.
Well, we're going to have one more segment,
yep.
and we'll do our best to bring you up to speed, and of course, give you some reasons why you should go visit the new Tucson Military Vehicle Museum, located right next to P. Marin Space. This is the Morning Voice, and we'll be right back with Scott Marchand. All right, we're back with the last segment with Scott Marchand, CEO with P. Marin Space, and we're talking about the newest museum, the Tucson Military Vehicle Museum. Scott, tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, so we're really excited to finally get that open to the public, and we'd hoped to get it opened a little bit earlier in the year and capture more of the tourist season, but we had some delays with permits and finalizing all the things that construction, things never go as expected, but it was a really smooth project, and we got past the finish line, and we're really proud of what we've done. Again, this is one of these things that, is a pretty unique and exceptional thing to have in this community and in Southern Arizona. We talked a little bit offline, and there's a large community domestically and internationally of aviation museums, and it's a very, very sort of strong, well-represented and visited enterprise, but certainly in North America, there aren't very many, you know, military vehicle museums that have like a strong, accessible daily public opening pattern, right? There's some terrific places, but they tend to be private collections, and they're in remote. I mean, there's a phenomenal one in northwestern Wyoming, but you know, it's 2.5 hours from the gates of Yellowstone, and there's another terrific one in the wilds of Hudson, Massachusetts, but it's 2.5 hours outside of Boston. You know, the U.S. military has several great collections, but they're, you know, behind the gates at restricted facilities in isolated communities. So, a military vehicle museum that sort of parallels the Air Museum's presentation doesn't really, you know, exist in a convenient location in this country, right? So we took our inspiration from a lot of the European, you know, museums. You know, the Imperial War Museum at Duxford has their land warfare hall and their hangars and their commercial hangars and their active runways and stuff. And, you know, of course, with a lot of, you know, the modern attractions visitors, they're looking for more, you know, an experience component. You know, I mean, there's lots of people who love museums as they are, but there's always people who are looking for a little more option and excitement, right? So we don't have a runway. Flying airplanes is a whole different challenge, and you know, there's higher risks involved, so that's never been part of what we've been able to do. But with the vehicle museum and our acreage, you know, we have a great facility, but you know, we've got a riding and driving program we're going to be launching towards the fall here, and it's a real innovation,
a chance to not only get inside but to drive
for certain things.
Okay, you know, so, all right, okay.
So if it's something that you, Tom, could buy and own with a like a standard driver's license, like say it's, you know, a cargo truck or Humvee or something, we're going to have that as a driving option. But if it's good, if it's got tracks on it, no.
So you're not going to be able to drive a tank?
No.
You have to go to California for that. There is a training ground where they let the generals drive tanks.
Yes.
But me, I was inside a tank moving, but I wasn't able to drive it.
No. A general nuisance doesn't count.
Yes, right. That's right.
Yeah. So we're looking forward to, you know, sky's the limit there too. I mean, you know, we've been able to leverage our existing relationships with our loan partners, with the U.S. government and our partners overseas. And, you know, we've got about 85 vehicles on display inside and outside now. We've got another 30 or 40 in storage that need a little more attention, tires and paint and that sort of thing. But we have more, you know, more loan opportunities coming in. We're actively purchasing certain things to fill in gaps. So we're optimistic that in, you know, 10 years, we're going to look not too different from the Air Museum side in terms of the scope and significance of the collection.
So share with us the website, because these are two separate museums.
Yes.
Sharing the same parking lot, pretty much.
Same driveway. Okay. I mean, the same access, right? You come in through the PMR's Visa the gate and follow the signs off to the east.
If you're so inclined, why not go to both? It just makes a lot of sense if you're very much into military, aviation. Mm-hmm. Seems like you would also be engaged in military vehicles as well. So, congratulations to you and your team for getting that open. And a lot of marketing about PMR and space going on. But tell us a little bit how we find out more information.
You know, our social media on Facebook and Instagram under PMR, TucsonMilitaryVehicle.org, Titan Missile Museum, it's all there. Our websites, TucsonMilitaryVehicle.org, PMR.org, TitanMissileMuseum.org. You know, even better, come and have a visit in person.
That's great. Well, Scott, thank you so much for being back here. It's been about 15 months since you were last here in the studio. We've grown a little bit here, over 2 hours now, the show, and we're on Facebook and other social media coming and in our new podcast studio. So thank you again for being a big part of that, big part of our beta check on our social media. And, you know, everyone, just let's go. I mean, you'll spend the day at PMR and Space in the Tucson military vehicle. I guarantee you it's affordable and it's worth your time with your family. So thank you again for all listening. All this is the Morning Voice. I'll be back next Thursday. Dr. Ackerley will be here tomorrow, Friday at 7 o'clock. And this is the Morning Voice.